Only 2 months before the thrilling 30s arrived, the stock market crashed. Few were aware of it yet, but the Great Depression had begun. President Hoover optimistically promised the country,
"Prosperity is just around the corner."
Many hopeful businessmen and politicians echoed the president's optimism.
"Tighten your belts another notch. Be patient for just a few more weeks."
Things got worse, so much worse that even white America's ears became attuned to the blues. Voicing the broken dreams, the heartache, and despair of millions of desperate, hungry Americans was Bessie Smith. Bessie, protégée of Ma Rainey, had a message for everybody, and her expanded popularity brought Columbia Records a new prosperity. All America, almost all the world, had the blues. Black bands and artists placated everyone's sorrow. Ida Cox, Josh White, Lonnie Johnson voiced the pain of the populace. Huddie Ledbetter became one of the better-known folk and blues singers, performing under the name Leadbelly. In the spring of 1932, World War I veterans, black and white, converged on Washington, D.C., and set up a tent camp to dramatize their demands for governmental action. But the government regarded these veterans as trespassers and vagrants. It was still the policy of the Hoover administration to regard the Depression as a temporary slump affecting mainly the stock market. But the jobless millions needed more than proclamations. It was with rising anticipation that the nation looked to the New Deal promised by Franklin Delano Roosevelt, elected president in 1932.
"So first of all, let me assert my firm belief that the only thing we have to fear is fear itself."
Roosevelt proposed, and Congress confirmed, several hopeful measures designed to pull the country out of the Depression. Roosevelt's propositions were to be applied equally to all citizens of whatever color. As a result, black Americans abandoned the Republican Party. Oscar DePriest failed to win re-election in 1934 and was replaced by the first black Democratic congressman, Chicago's Arthur Mitchell. Helpful to Mitchell's success were the blacks hired by the new administration. Many of these blacks became members of what was called Roosevelt's Black Cabinet. The president was not yet ready to concede that a black might have an opinion worth listening to on any other subject except the country's Negro problem. Black author Roy Ottley wrote after visiting several government offices,
"I was frankly surprised when I was in Washington recently to see the thousands of Negroes who were working for the government and to see the variety of jobs they were doing, jobs hitherto beyond wishful thinking."
Some of the black consultants prominent in the Roosevelt administration were Mary McLeod Bethune, Robert C. Weaver, William Henry Hastie, and Ralph Bunche, all of whom were later recognized for their contributions to humanity. 1934 saw Arkansanian black and white sharecroppers organize the Southern Tenant Farmers Union in a schoolhouse. During the debate over separate unions for blacks and whites, one old farmer rose to speak.
"We live under the same sun, raise the same crop for the same landlord who oppresses and cheats us both. The same chain that holds my people holds your people too. If we're chained together on the outside, we ought to stay chained together in the union."
By the next year, Ward Rogers, a white organizer for the union, was able to report,
"The only explanation I have for sharecroppers joining our interracial organization who used to show their race prejudice by being members of the Not Riding KKK is that they have learned that both white and nigger sharecroppers are the victims of the same system of exploitation. Both nigger and white suffer from the same belly hunger."
Although many new projects created by the administration were instrumental in helping some blacks get work, the conditions under which they were hired were often more degrading than to remain jobless. John P. Davis made this report on conditions at Tennessee Valley Authority, or TVA, construction sites.
"Negro workers are employed by Negro assistant personnel officers under the supervision of white officials. To the Negro assistants, only requisition of unskilled work are given. At Wheeler Dam, in June 1935, There were 300 white carpenters employed on the job there, but not a single Negro.
The Civilian Conservation Corps, popularly known as the CCC, was another government project where discrimination against blacks was emphasized, although some found a way to live with it. Luther C. Wandel joined the CCC in 1935.
According to instructions, I went Monday morning at 8 o'clock to Pier 1, North River. There was, I suppose, more than 1,000 boys standing about the pier. Good many Spaniards and Italians was about. Good-natured, lively crowd. Typical of New York, you know. Before we left the bus, the officer shouted, "Color boys, fall out in the rear." Well, the color from several buses was herded together, stood in line till after the white boys had been registered and taken to their tents. This seemed to be the established order of procedure at Camp Dix. Now, on the whole, I was gratified rather than disappointed with the CCC. I had expected the worst. But as a job and an expense for a man who ain't got no work, I can hardly recommend it.
There were two groups of blacks who were able to maintain their former ways of life and sometimes improve them, entertainers and servants. Harlem nightclubs were still playgrounds for those whites able to afford it. There, they heard a newly developing jazz sound, a style that soon came to be called swing. Fletcher Henderson led the foremost orchestra of the time. Other popular bands in the forefront of this new sound were those of Don Redman, Duke Ellington, Cab Calloway, and Jimmy Lunsford. Dances created by black performers on the dance floors of Harlem swept the country, the Charleston, the Black Bottom, the Big Apple, the Lindy Hop. White musicians and band leaders were the most avid visitors to the, quote, Harlem hotspots. They tried to emulate their black counterparts, but found it difficult to capture the spirit of the black dance bands. Paul Whiteman, whose orchestra contained many of the legendary white jazz musicians, was never able to produce the proper musical backgrounds to give them the true freedom to play jazz solos. Benny Goodman hired Fletcher Henderson to write arrangements for his band. As a result, Benny Goodman's band won the Downbeat Reader's Poll as the top swing band in the land and created the title King of Swing. Quick to catch on, Tommy Dorsey hired Jimmy Lunsford arranger Cy Oliver to write for his band, and Jimmy Dorsey hired Don Redman. Soon, Tommy Dorsey won the Downbeat Poll as King of Swing, and Jimmy Dorsey won as King of Sweet. A few years later, the immaculate Duke Ellington astounded the public by winning in both categories, sweet and swing, in the same year. During this period, a new phenomenon was developing. Religious leaders appeared proclaiming themselves in direct contact with God, and that only through them could the oppressed be saved. One man was Father Divine. Father Divine gathered large followings in New York and nearby states. Members of his flock were called angels, and were completely devoted to him. His organization amassed great wealth, most of which was used to aid the poor blacks of the community. His most appreciated venture was the opening of peace kitchens in many black areas. Here, a hungry person could buy a complete meal for as little as 10 cents. He later bought a large hotel as living quarters for his angels and as headquarters for his movement. The hotel was, of course, called Heaven. Father Divine was a mystery all through his career. Years after his death, we have only his own account of his origin.
I wasn't born. I was combusted, full grown, in 1900 on the corner of 7th Avenue and 134th Street in Harlem.
In Washington, D.C., Bishop C.M. Grace, Daddy Grace, was proclaimed a deity. Daddy Grace, like Father Divine, established hotels and restaurants for his followers. His services were unique. They were always accompanied by at least a 7-to-10-piece orchestra. Perhaps the most flamboyant religious leader was Chicago's Prophet Jones. The prophet was careful never to let his feet touch the ground. Wherever he went, a red carpet was rolled out for him to walk on. His pulpit and throne were draped in solid red. and to Blenn, his congregation saw to it that he was draped in a regal white ermine robe. The most modest of the new religious leaders was Elijah Poole, known as Elijah Muhammad, messenger of Allah, Allah, God, in the person of Master W. Ford Muhammad, the long-awaited Messiah of the Christians and the Mahdi of the Muslims, appeared to Elijah in 1930. Elijah Muhammad, messenger of Allah, established Mosque No. 1 in Detroit and some 48 others throughout the nation. The Muslim religion under his leadership has created a totally independent society, complete with schools, businesses, a police force, and a newspaper, Muhammad Speaks, dedicated to freedom, justice, and equality for the so-called Negro. One of the brothers expresses the dedication of the fold.
And the scriptures that they brought to the people. We believe in the resurrection of the dead, not in a physical resurrection, but in mental resurrection. We believe that the so-called Negroes are most in need of mental resurrection.
The combination of jazz and religion, considered by some a sacrilege, has existed for several decades. Thomas A. Dorsey, a black jazz pianist who can be heard on many jazz and blues recordings accompanying Ma Rainey, is the genius who combined jazz with spirituals to create gospel music. Thomas A. Dorsey's gospel sound bore the world such gospel greats as Clara Ward, James Cleveland, Rosetta Tharpe, The Caravans, The Mighty Clouds of Joy, and many others. In sports, the prowess of blacks moved slowly following the era of Jack Johnson. Blacks had played professional football from 1919, but one effect of the Depression was that they were no longer chosen. Joe Lillard played his last season with the Chicago Cardinals in 1933, and for the next 13 years, professional football was an all-white sport. In baseball, as early as the 1890s, blacks had formed their own teams and leagues, the Negro National and the Negro American Leagues. There were teams such as the Birmingham Black Barons, the Cincinnati Clowns, the Kansas City Monarchs, etc. The winter leagues in the Caribbean and Latin America were integrated, often with black coaches and managers. But giants of the game, such as Josh Gibson, who hit 80 home runs one season, remain obscure to the general public.
At Madison Square Garden, the Harlem Globetrotters play the New York Celtics and come up with a few new tricks of the trade. Look out now. Deuce Tatum proves they can really play. Fabulous Marquise Haynes in an exhibition of dexterous dribbling.
In track and field events, the greatest one-man show ever presented at the Olympic Games was by Jesse Owens. The 1936 Olympics was held in Berlin. Owens won the 100-meter dash, tying the world record set at the 1932 Olympics by Eddie Tolan. He set an Olympic record in the 200-meter dash, but it was his performance in the running broad jump which was most outstanding. The judges repeatedly disqualified his jumps, claiming he had fouled by taking off beyond the line. Finally, Jesse Owens marked his takeoff point with a piece of chalk 1 or 2 feet behind the official line. On his next and final attempt, Owens took off at his own line, eliminating all possibility of a foul charge. Despite this handicap, Jesse Owens soared to an Olympic and world record in the broad jump that was to stand unbroken for 24 years.
Jesse, what is your immediate plan?
My immediate plan for the present time is that I'm going back home. I'm going back to the university to finish my year in college. I have another year, as you all know, and I want to get my degree in the end of June.
In boxing, word came from Detroit of a talented young heavyweight named Joe Louis. In 1935, after defeating former champion Primo Canale, Louis gained the nickname the Brown Bomber. In 1937, he defeated Jimmy Braddock for the heavyweight championship of the world. Black fight fans were elated. The big prize had been won. Joe Louis, a modest and unassuming champion, won the admiration and respect of every American. Concert and operatic audiences thrilled to the sound of Marian Anderson and acclaimed her the world's greatest contralto. At the age of 23, she appeared as soloist with the New York Philharmonic Orchestra and later the Philadelphia Symphony Orchestra. Following her European studies, she returned for a triumphant debut at New York's Town Hall. Howard Taubman, music critic for the New York Times, rhapsodized that it was
music making that probed too deep for words.
Miss Anderson's greatest triumph came 3 years later. Arrangements were made for her to give a concert at Washington's Constitution Hall. But the group which owned the building refused to allow her to sing there. The site was shifted outdoors to the Lincoln Memorial. There, on a chilly Easter Sunday in 1939, Marian Anderson warmed the heart of the 75,000 people who filled the mall from the Lincoln Memorial to the Washington Monument.
Looking back on this occasion brings up many, many thoughts and great emotions, and the realization that life can bring to you at a very unexpected moment a test which will certainly call upon every emotion that you have and give you an opportunity to see how nearly you may be able to rise to the occasion.
As the decade approached its end, drums of war began a tattoo that would echo around the world. The coming of the warring 40s, 50s, and 60s. The fascisti of Italy attacked without warning the defenseless African nation Ethiopia. The primitive weapons of Haile Selassie's Ethiopia were no match for the new heavily armored tanks and strafing fighter planes of the Italians. Germany allied herself with Italy for the dress rehearsal of a planned Nazi-fascist European takeover by attacking Spain. Arthur Mitchell, still the only black United States congressman, noted the persecution of Jews in Europe by the fascist hordes. Mitchell sent a telegram to President Roosevelt on October 12, 1938.
We believe that the same spirit of intolerance which is working so tremendously against the safety and sacred rights of the Jewish people, if permitted to go unchallenged, will manifest itself sooner or later against all minority groups.
Unfortunately, there was little the president could do except express his agreement with Mitchell and promise to help establish a Jewish nation in Palestine. The Hitler-Mussolini team soon submerged all of Europe into war.
Im heutigen Deutschland steht man kein Ultimaten mehr, das kann man den Lohn nicht.
A. Philip Randolph, highest ranking black labor leader, demanded open acceptance of blacks in all industry, and particularly in defense. In New York City, there were 30,000 defense workers, but only 142 were black. Randolph's entreaties fell on deaf ears. Finally, he proposed and began organizing a march on Washington by thousands of the nation's blacks. Only 4 days before the march was to begin, the president invited Randolph and the other organizers to the White House. The march organizers were able to extract a promise of immediate action from the president, and the march was canceled. The result of this promise was a presidential executive order on June 25, 1941, banning discrimination in all defense industries and the establishment of a Fair Employment Practices Committee. More and more black Americans were achieving recognition in diverse fields. In 1939, Jane Bolan, became the first black woman to be appointed judge in any court in the United States. In 1940, the state of Virginia adopted black composer James A. Bland's Carry Me Back to Old Virginia as the official state song. Benjamin O. Davis, career soldier, was promoted to the rank of Brigadier General, the first black American in history to attain that rank. The United States Navy policy, however, was strictly segregationist. It was the Navy's practice to assign blacks to menial positions. The West Virginia, one of the Pacific Fleet, was riding serenely at anchor in Pearl Harbor on Sunday morning, December 7th, 1941. Japanese planes bombed and strafed the ships of the fleet and onshore installations. Mess attendant Dory Miller rushed up on deck and pulled his wounded captain to safety. Returning to the deck, Miller spotted an unmanned machine gun and began firing at the airborne menace. This messman, who had never before fired a machine gun, scored 6 kills and thus became America's first hero of the Second World War. On May 7, 1942, Dory Miller was awarded the Navy Cross by Admiral of the Fleet, Chester Nimitz.
For distinguished devotion to duty, extraordinary courage, and disregard for his own
personal safety. On December 8, 1941, President Roosevelt went before the assembled houses of Congress to request a declaration of war against Japan.
I ask that the Congress declare that since the unprovoked and dastardly attack by Japan on Sunday, December 7th, 1941, a state of war has existed between the United States and the Japanese Empire.
Over a million blacks, men and women, served in the armed forces of the United States during World War II. In Europe, black troops were among the first ashore in every major invasion. General B.O. Davis's son, Colonel B.O. Davis Jr., a West Point graduate, was the highest ranking black officer in the Air Corps. The 99th Pursuit Squadron and the 332nd Fighter Group won a combined total of 800 air medals and clusters. After their initial resistance at the Normandy invasion in June 1944, the Nazi forces quickly began to retreat. But suddenly in November, Nazi units in Belgium staged a counterattack, breaking through Allied lines and almost completely encircling an American unit. Volunteers were called to help push back the advancing Germans and rescue the trapped unit. Some 5,000 black soldiers volunteered, half of whom were accepted to fight in the Battle of the Bulge. For the first time in the war, integrated units went into battle. The Stars and Stripes reported.
Negro doughboys are participating in the eastward sweep by General Hodges' force. With comments of white personnel, if these divisions are any indication, the plan of mixing white and colored troops and fighting units, a departure from previous United States Army practice, is operating successfully. The CO of K Company, Captain Wesley J. Simons of Snow Hill, Maryland, said,
"I was damn glad to get those boys. They fit into our company like any other platoon, and they fight like hell."
Black fighting men were part of the island-hopping offensive against the Japanese. In 1943, for the first time in its history, the United States Marines had dropped the color bar and accepted blacks in its ranks. April 12, 1945, President Franklin Delano Roosevelt died in Warm Springs, Georgia, of a cerebral hemorrhage. May 7, 1945, Germany unconditionally surrendered. The war in Europe was over. The war in the Pacific raged on. The United States had developed a secret weapon, the atomic bomb. On August 6, 1945, this terrifying weapon was dropped on Hiroshima. 3 days later, a second bomb fell on Nagasaki. A formal surrender of the Japanese War Command was accepted on September 2, 1945. The joy and relief of the American public knew no bounds. Ecstatic crowds poured into the streets. President Roosevelt had promised that this was the war to end all wars.